Yes, a couple of questions in the box from a couple of weeks ago about love and love and the Buddhist path. Could we say something about that? Okay. Well, I think the entirety of the Buddhist training is a training in love. I don't think there's any doubt about that. It is designed to teach us what love is, not just intellectually, but to really show us what love is, to be able to train in developing the capacity to love, not just the things that we like, but also the things that we don't like, and ultimately to realize this wonderful transcendent love of which all traditions, spiritual traditions, talk about, which the mystics talk about and the poets allude to. So the entire path really is a path of love. I went to see my teacher today, and as normal, he asks me what I was going to talk about, and when I said I was going to be talking to you about love, he started laughing and said, "Good luck." As he often does, which I was like, okay, right, now that's really fired me up. But the point he made is well, there are as many ways to define love as there are people in the world. How are you going to define it? And he's got a point, because this card here is just splattered with different definitions of love that I came up with, and I'm sure you'll have your own. So it can only be an edited highlights tonight, I'm afraid. So I've got a few different kinds I could mention. Some people, when they think of love, are actually concerned with greed. They love the things that they can acquire and consume and enjoy. So I'll go through these quite quickly, but that's one way in which people define love. Consuming the things that they enjoy. I also have to mention, of course, love making. I'll look up here when I took that. Because, of course, it's got it in the name, hasn't it? It's like we make love. And for many people, that is what they consider love to be. And, of course, associated with that is any form of attraction. Oh, I love that. Oh, look at that. And so the beauty in something, where something has qualities which we consider to be good, so where any form of attraction is considered to be a form of love. For a lot of people, it's interesting when we talk about attachment with regard to Buddhism, some people mistake non-attachment to mean that you can't love anything anymore. So they very much identify an emotional dependency upon someone or something as being love. So they consider that to be love. As in, oh, Stan, promise me you'll never leave me. You know, that sort of... That's love. Kind of. We also have people... Sorry about that. I was dying to say that. I don't know who Stan is, by the way. There's also passion for something. So somebody has a passion for something, be it pottery or saving the world or whatever it might be. And so that is a thing that they have love for, and they call it their passion. So that's another definition. Oh, there's another one along the lines of relationships, of course, finding one's soulmate and having that intimate bond with another human being. That's very much regarded as love, isn't it? For many people, that seems to be a fairly elusive kind of love, but nonetheless, it's what a lot of people are trying to find. Any form of caring for something or someone and showing kindness and friendliness is regarded as love, isn't it? And as I was mentioning earlier, giving one's full, undivided attention to something. Yes, you're all just demonstrating that for me, thank you. they are all forms, regarded as all forms of love. You'll notice, I'm sure you'll have noticed, the way in which the centre has always been kept, simplicity, lack of jumble, and the gardens too, kept as impeccably as we can. Impeccability is also a form of love, and the reason we do it, of course, is because it does help mind states. There is more of a loving atmosphere when you come to the centre than there is when you go down the pub, I hope, because far more care is taken. So it communicates. Generosity, of course, is another form of, it's, you know, people like to show their love by being generous, not just in gifts, but, well, giving someone your full and undivided attention when they're not very happy and they want to talk about their problems, which sometimes can be a bit, oh, come on, get on with it. You know, and it takes a certain amount of restraint and willingness to restrain and to listen attentively in order that they can offload. So that's a form of generosity, that's a form of love. And then going right to the complete other end of the spectrum, you have a burgeoning opening up to life, a burgeoning opening to the wonder and the mystery of life, and increasing levels of acceptance of whatever you find, and realizing that everything that happens is a wonder and a mystery. And so that's opening up into the more transcendental kind of love that all these spiritual ways tend towards. Ultimately, to find in the last analysis that we are beings of love and we have infinite reservoir. Well, it's not even a reservoir, it's bigger than a reservoir. It's an infinite store or potential for love, to be loving beings, which is the culmination of the spiritual path, is to discover exactly what that means really, rather than simply alluding to it. Whether you understand that as enlightenment or the kingdom of God or however it is that you understand that to be. Trying to sum all that up, I discovered quite handily that all these different definitions of love fall into three very handy groups. There's a group that consists of entirely selfish behaviour. There's a group that includes all relatively unselfish behaviour. And then there's the group that belongs to going beyond the self or ideas of self and other entirely, which is the way in which the Buddhist path does indeed break down, because the Buddha is saying or the training is asking us to learn to let go of our selfish preoccupations and our selfish behaviours, learning to quell them, to put them down, to renounce them, to surrender them, to go beyond them. It's training us in developing the relatively unselfish behaviours, the generosity, the kindness, the caring, and so forth, with a view ultimately to realising for ourselves this transcendental love, this love that is just absolutely accepting of everything. So there are just so many aspects of the path that I could talk about. There is no way. This just has to be a brief edited highlights package for you, because when I started looking at it, there was not one thing that did not relate to love. For example, keeping precepts. Keeping the five Buddhist precepts is an act of love. It's surrendering the selfish behaviours, the greedy behaviours, recognising that those kinds of behaviours do actually lead to suffering to ourselves, because it is about genuinely loving ourselves and having a really healthy view of ourselves. So it's letting go of behaviours that are damaging to ourselves, damaging to other people, and exploiting other people, and of course to us both, both oneself and others. So the five Buddhist precepts are to refrain from killing or harming living creatures, to refrain from stealing, to refrain from sexual misconduct, to refrain from all forms of wrong speech, and to refrain from mind-altering drink and drugs. So as you can see, that anyone who enters into that is letting go of the selfish, developing relatively unselfish attitude, and that really is an act of love. And that, of course, that has many different levels and aspects to it. It's about living a moderate life. Now, in all of this, it's not cutting off your nose to spite your face. It's not doing without. Everyone needs me time. We all need a certain amount of pleasure in our life and pleasurable activities. It's just that what this generates is an intelligence about what is genuinely in our best interest and what isn't. Even the Buddha had downtime. Even the Buddha had me time, even though he knew there was no me. He would disappear off and, you know, meditate by himself every day, because we all need personal space. We all need personal time to ourselves. So it's not doing without all pleasure in life. That would be ridiculous. But it is learning through experience to use one's intelligence about what is, from one's own experience, what about what is genuinely one's best interest. Oh, and respect. Yes, so respect for oneself and others too. Another area of in which the training develops our capacity for love is in mindfulness. Let's take mindfulness on the physical basis first. So I was talking before about impeccability. So having respect for objects. So when somebody's on an integrated retreat, for instance, we give them little work duties. And the idea is that one, I don't mean like bowing down to the shears or anything like that. I just mean having a respect for them. So when you when somebody uses the garden shears, once they've used them, they give them a quick clean before putting them back in the box. Or if they're hoovering the carpet, that they're careful not to bang against the skirting board. All these little things are showing respect for and love for your environment. And so they're developing your capacity to see your world as lovable. And that is tremendously beneficial. Not only does it mean that the space that you're in is far more harmonious, but we do everything with our mind. There isn't anything we don't use our mind for. I was trying to think of something we didn't use our mind for, but I couldn't think of anything. So if you're developing the capacity to be mindful of your external world, you're developing the capacity to be mindful of what's going on indoors. And when we're bashing into things, when we're dropping things, when we're being a bit of a nuisance externally, it's because we're not aware of what we're doing internally. So not only is it an act of love externally, the very act of being mindful is an act of love internally as well. So because you start to become aware of your internal mental behaviour, which is critical if you want to be happy. What is mindfulness? It is giving your full, undivided attention to things, to external things and to internal things. So if you want to improve your mindfulness, generally around the house, learn to treat all the objects that you own with respect. Even if it's, you know, just some cutlery or a glass tumbler or something, it's just actually seeing it, being there with it, recognising that it is there, it is a thing. And through that act of love and treating it with respect, you find, well, one thing is you don't break as many glass tumblers in your life, which is a good thing. But more important than that, it is an act of love. Another area in which love is developed through the training is, of course, metta, loving-kindness, meditation. Now, in all spiritual traditions, you will get some form of... This is going to sound a little bit wishy-washy, quite wishy-washy for me, anyway. Heart-opening, heart-energy, releasing exercises. For instance, when I go to my yoga, we start doing all this sort of stuff, and it's all about opening up the heart and stuff, which is actually very, very good and very beneficial. So you will find in most spiritual traditions, I think all spiritual traditions, there is emphasis placed on the heart and developing heart energy. In Buddhism, we use metta, practice of developing a friendly outlook to all beings. And we do so in order to overcome the opposite of friendliness, which is, of course, hatred. All forms of hatred, ill will, irritation, from the most slight irritation to the most blood-curdling rage. One of the ways of overcoming hatred is giving gifts. It's one of the recommended ways, and of course generosity is an act of love. And many people enjoy the act of giving because it is a demonstration of their love for somebody. The Buddha talks about there being three kinds of generosity. He talked about there being beggarly giving, which is where you're actually giving in order to get rid of something you no longer want. I'm sure we've all been a recipient of that from time to time. There's giving to get. So that's a bit of almost emotional blackmail. I'll give you this because I want you to treat me a certain way. I want you to perceive me a certain way. So it's that's not... Neither of those two are the best way of giving. The very best way of giving is kingly giving, where you give free, entirely freely. Where in giving that gift to somebody, you are completely surrendering any ownership of the gift, or indeed ownership of the giving. So that person is free to do whatever they want to do with that gift. They can just like hurl it out the window if they want. You don't mind, because it was given out of a genuine sense of wanting that person to receive. And that really is the best kind of giving. Loving kindness is an act of giving. Loving kindness is a tremendous act of generosity in itself. If you think about it, you're giving your time and your energy to sitting down with your eyes closed to think about somebody else and to think about all their good qualities, or at least some of their good qualities, and to genuinely wish them well. Free of any attachment, you can do with that whatever you like, but I'm just giving you that freely, that heart energy is being given to you completely freely. And so it really is a tremendous act of generosity. It is an act of love, as long as it isn't giving to get, or isn't beggarly giving. If it's kingly giving, kingly giving in that sense, it really does help to reduce self-concern. It really does help to open up life, open up communications with people. You learn the language of the heart. I should point out that there are no shoulds, are they? But it is really helpful to start with yourself. To spend time treating yourself with the same friendliness and generosity and respect with which you're hoping to develop towards other people. How can we give it unless we feel it within ourselves, towards ourselves? One of the major problems we have in our culture is self-hatred. And it is so utterly unnecessary and unhelpful, and yet so many people go in for it. We need to be generous towards ourselves. That's not egotistical. People think, if I'm thinking about myself, I'm being egotistical. No, it's about how you think about yourself. Is it greedy thinking? Or is it actually intelligently considering your genuine good qualities and wishing yourself well? You can tell when somebody's got the loving kindness going. You don't have to be a sort of wonder, mystical being in order to appreciate it. You just have to be relatively mindful. But some people radiate loving kindness. They just, it's often been, not often, but sometimes it's the case that on retreat, someone comes to see me for an interview, and it's like their heart energy arrives a few seconds before they do. And you just go, whoa, oh, hello. And you're suddenly, you're just there, sitting there fairly equanimously, and suddenly you're just absolutely delighted to see them. You know, why am I suddenly so delighted to see them? It's their, that heart energy, it's that loving kindness. It is palpable. When somebody gets it going, it is really palpable. Why is this person so attractive to me? Time to practice restraint, then. So, another area of Buddhism which is developing a loving attitude towards life is vipassana meditation, insight meditation. Now, this kind of needs a little bit more work as to understand how or why. Firstly, the first point of view, point we need to make is, of course, before you can practice vipassana meditation properly, you have to deal effectively with hindrances. The hindrances are the things that stop full and undivided attention to life as it unfolds moment by moment. And we need this attention to our subjective experience in order to understand how transient everything is and how you can't grasp onto anything. The hindrances divide the mind. They take us off our chosen task and we just fall into fantasies, daydreams, worries, pet hates, you know, you name it. I'm sure you've experienced them yourselves. At least I hope you have. If you haven't experienced any hindrances, what are you doing here? You don't need to be here. The hindrances are our selfish behaviour. This is very much in keeping with this idea about letting go of the selfishness, developing relatively unselfish actions in order to ultimately transcend this view of self completely. So first, we need to let go of the hindrances in meditation. We need to learn to put them aside, to practice restraint, to practice mindfulness, to become ever more clear about where our mind goes and learning how to bring the mind back. But that can only be done with a really healthy, positive self-image, which is why everything that we've done or talked about so far is so valuable. To genuinely love yourself means that you are far more able to accept your demons. You are far more able to accept the things about yourself that you think shouldn't be there. Because the fact is, they are there. What are you going to do about it? You can either resist them and hate them and therefore hate yourself for being in such a pickle, or you can learn to love your warts, to love the bits about you that are less than entirely wholesome, and acknowledge and accept that they're there. Because the moment you do, you truly surrender to them and allow them to be there. Funniest thing happens is they stop. They just disappear. Not forever, but for the time being, they're just brought into abeyance. And what feeds them and fuels them and keeps them going is that very resistance. It's the fact that the idea, this should not be happening. This is spoiling my meditation. So there has to be an awful lot of genuine self-love that has to be developed. And everything that we've talked about so far will give us that solid sense of us being decent human beings, because when we look back on our behaviour, we can look back with love and say, well, yeah, I made a few mistakes. I mean, even the ability to say, yeah, I made a few mistakes is a sign that you love yourself. Somebody who says, oh, I should never make a mistake ever, doesn't love themselves. Don't appreciate that they're a human being, which is a shame. Wonder what they think they are. So, we put the hindrances to one side. It may very well take a lot of time and experience and development in order to learn how to do that effectively. But the more we practice, the more we're able to put these unwanted neurotic tendencies to one side. And that allows us to observe reality as it unfolds and allows us to deepen our understanding of transience and the fact that there's nothing we can really grasp onto in experience that everything is so fleeting that the hand of the mind goes out to try and grasp onto something, and it just fails each time because it's gone by the time you've even acknowledged that it's there. How does this lead us to love? It doesn't sound very loving in and of itself. But what stops us from truly being in love with life are our attachments. When we attach to something, to anything, we immediately create fear, the fear of the loss of that thing. We develop emotional attachments and emotional dependencies to things which not might let us down, but that will let us down, irrespective of what they are. Now, love is not attachment. And some people get very confused about attachment to their children as opposed to love for their children. But the two things are completely different. To be attached to a child means that there is an emotional dependency on that child for something. I haven't had a kid myself, I wouldn't personally know what they might be. But I suspect it's around the thing, sort of things that the parent might have expectations for the child. Whereas love for the child would be a little bit of a step back. And so I was sort of wondering, it would be interesting to see how this being develops. Yes, of course, I'll try to teach it right from wrong. I'll try to give it opportunities and a chance in life. But it'll be interesting to see how it develops. So it's love doesn't have that same grasping quality that attachment does. And I think sometimes people get confused between the two. The absence of attachment is an entirely positive thing. And you can't really know what love is while you've still got attachments. Not really. The objective of observing transience and the ungraspability and the uncontrollability of life is it means that in all aspects of life, it's meaning that you just let go, and in letting go, you stop projecting your own wants, fears, worry, neurosis onto what's there, and through the absence of the attachment, you see what's truly there. So instead of seeing your own projection, you see what's truly there. Once you've got attachments to things, you've got a divided mind. It's not at peace. It's not happy. Because it's always worried. It's always fearful about the loss of the things it depends upon. Whereas when there's no attachment, there is no worry, there is no fear. There is no longing for life to be one way or another. And the truly happy mind and the truly peaceful mind is an undivided mind, because it isn't grasping after life, so it just rests and enjoys what's there. I keep coming back to a phrase that I use a lot, which I think about a lot, I don't tend to use, which is love is the absence of division. So whilst there is this division between me and that, whilst there is this sense of duality at work, there is this constant division. But in the absence of that self-view, there is just love. Anyone who's concentrated successfully, by that I mean they've got free of hindrances, and they've given their full, undivided attention to, say, the rise and fall of the breath. Anyone who's successfully done that, to the exclusion of absolutely everything else, finds that for the duration of that concentration period, there is just the most blissful peace and contentment. Because at that time, there's no comparing. There's no wishing life to be different. There is no awareness of self. There is just the sheer experience. And it's blissful. It's peaceful. And the thought arises, I wish this would last forever. which point of course there's a comparison, and suddenly, oh, who wishes it was there forever, and of course re-establishes the self. Now the whole purpose of Vipassana meditation isn't for a temporary reprieve from that sense of division in life, but it is through understanding, and it is just understanding, nothing really gets lost in that wasn't already there. It's just an understanding of life that shows us that that division is actually between me and the universe is actually just a false idea. It's just a false perception. It's just a mistake. And when you finally see through it, you then realise what the mystics have been talking about all this time, and what the poets allude to but never quite seem to realise themselves, and for them it's always unrequited, isn't it? But you realise that love is our natural state, that love is the undivided state. Because in that state, that love has no opposite. It's not, you know, these people have love on tattooed on one knuckle and hate on the other knuckle. It's not, I don't know what the opposite of hate is, but it's not love, because love has no opposite. Because in our natural state, undeluded state, we don't take the comparisons between good and bad seriously, or right and wrong, or this should be here and that shouldn't be there. You realise that life as it presents itself is perfect, just as it is, whatever's there. And to my mind, that's the best definition of love that you could possibly have. But it isn't even acceptance, because acceptance has this connotation of choice. And enlightenment, call it what you will, is utterly beyond choice. It's just the absolute freedom of being. There's no choices to be made. Everything's perfect as it is. You realise that there is just this infinite capacity. Love is our natural state, and there is just this infinite capacity for love and loving. It doesn't have to be in your face. It's not like somebody has to go about like proving it the whole time. If someone is going around the whole time having to try to prove how much love they've got, then leave me alone. It's just, you know, there's just this endless reservoir of potential for love and a loving attitude towards life. You just see life as inherently perfect.